right, welcome to this edition, this holiday edition of Running Wild. It's a beautiful time of year. You get together with your family. But today we're going to look at a couple symbols that have permeated our culture. First of all, who is this bearded man who we go and plop our children down upon? Ho, 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 indeed, people. Who is Santa Claus? Well, I would put forth that Santa Claus is a blending, a strange Franken-monster of two distinct characters. The first is Santa Claus. Now, Santa Claus, Sinterklaas, Saint Nicholas, whatever name you want to call him, was an actual person. He was the Bishop of Myra in present-day Turkey. In the 11th century, after he's martyred for his beliefs, his relics are moved to Italy, making it a beautiful church holiday. His day is December 5th. Now, St. Nicholas, Sinterklaas, was a gift giver of sorts. He was very well loved for his tradition or his custom of putting little gold pieces in the poor shoes, throwing in a bag of gold when people didn't have enough dowry to sell off their daughters.
He's also currently like the perfect figurehead for the patriarch of capitalism.
Now, St. Nicholas is a very revered person. And we'll mention that his day is December 5th. He's still celebrated on December 5th in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in Germany, in France. He's got anywhere that there's Roman Catholicism that still kicks around and they love their saints. St. Nicholas is right up there. He loves his kids. He loves sailors. He's the patron saint of all of Greece. But, I mean, the church is very it's very careful about the way it portrays its figureheads. You don't see, like, here's a shot of the Pope in his pajamas. You don't see that, right? Anytime you see a photo of the Pope, it's very well orchestrated. It has a large papal hat, robes, a staff. So how does St. Nicholas, a real human being, get turned into this fat guy in PJs that you go and sit on his leg? Well, here's one story. Washington Irving in 1808, St. Nicholas gets brought to America by the colony of New Amsterdam. And New Amsterdam is New York. In 1808, Washington Irving publishes Life in New York. And for the first time, you see an illustration of a mocking St. Nicholas, a mocking, a funny-looking Santa Claus. Now, because the new British culture
empire
has supplanted the empire, right, thank you, Sue, has supplanted the Dutch colony, they've got to make all the Dutch icons and figureheads look dumb. So Santa Claus gets painted up as a disheveled, slightly rotund Dutch sailor in robes and pajamas, and then, you know, people pick up on that. But it's still December 5th. Why did he get to be December 25th? There's a lot of pagan holidays. Solstice is right around that time of year. It's a very important time of year. It's the longest night. We gotta chase away those winter blahs, so light your Beltrán fires. Oh, here comes Odin. Here comes the bearded guy. Here comes an archetypal image of God, a judgmental bearded fellow. We still every now and then get to see that guy kicking around, "Hi, I'm God," in the cartoons. He's a big bearded guy who wears robes. He doesn't really have anything to do with children. He doesn't really have anything to do with giving you garbage on Christmas Day. He's just sort of God. Now, what's happened is we've melded Santa Claus, the gift-giving saint, with an archetypal image of God. Santa Claus, Saint Nicholas, and there was never any idea of him being able to fly. He couldn't live at the North Pole. He didn't have a sleigh full of reindeer. So we've given him magical powers beyond Santa Claus. Saint Nicholas is the real guy, his powers. We've given him godlike powers. He can now see you. He knows when you've been good or bad. That's kind of frightening, wouldn't you say? Oh, God, you know, oh, great judge. But we've confused the idea, so we've created this splinter product Santa Claus pagan god thing creature who now is very frightening. And like I was saying, what we do from our very beginning is we teach our kids that this creature, this god, this but also strange god of consumerism, which is our new religion, is to be prayed to fervently. We can write him letters. What do we want? What do I want? Oh, dear God. So the very notion of praying, which is a beautiful human interaction with a deity or with the divine, for attempting to pray to something is beautiful. And what do? We teach our children to pray for things. Pray for what you want. Pray for your new dollhouse. Because, oh, here's God. There he is. There. He's a big bearded guy, and he looks funny, and he's kind of overweight, and he can fly through the sky. Now pray to him and tell him what you want, and it will magically appear. And don't forget to feed him, or else he'll be angry. and go to sleep so you can't see him. And then we realized later our parents lied to us, but, you know, in those first formative years, that was who we believed God was. That was the most magical creature in all of our lives. Santa Claus, perhaps the Tooth Fairy to a lesser degree, and also a giant rabbit that throws chocolate eggs at us. But God, Santa Claus, was right up there. We love that guy. Love him, and we believe he's real.
I'd be really interested to find out how the elves fit into this picture, too. I mean...
Ah, no, elves.
Santa, you know, he is that jolly old fellow that we all loved and adored and waited for at one point. And, I mean, there's nothing quite like seeing the look in a 3 or 4-year-old's eyes as you have your brother dressed up in a Santa suit sprinting through the yard and the kids are thinking that it really is Santa. I mean, there is that magical, fun...
It's great.
Atmosphere that Santa
spread. It's a lovely time of year, and Santa spreads good cheer and ho-ho-ho-ness all over the damn place. The only thing that I would begrudge Santa was just the fact that, like, it's all tied up in, like, buy something, here you go. It's not like, hey, Santa loves you, kids. Santa just loves you because God loves you, and it's a beautiful earth that we live upon, and, you know,
so
let's
characterize
him here. It's supplanted with this, like, let's buy something, and Santa will bring it to us. God brings us presents that we bought at the mall. It's really weird.
So how do we overcome that then?
Well,
like, what do we teach our children instead?
Can I just interject with a funny elf fact for you,
Sue? I love facts
about
elves.
Let's never begrudge the Dutch their wacky and zany sense of humor. Anybody who's ever lived in Holland will know.
They have the best semen.
Those Dutch are funny. You would know that better than I, Sue. Here we go. Up until the 1950s, St. Nicholas had some helpers. He had helpers. Now let's remember, the Dutch love their slavery, or at least they used to. St. Nicholas's helpers? Prior to the 1950s, prior to large immigrations of, shall we say, less Dutch than the Dutch people to Holland, his helpers were black boys, Sue, and you can look that up and you will find that St. Nicholas's original helpers were black boys, and then they became black-faced white guys because there weren't a lot of real blacks with any, you know, degree of freedom in Holland. And then when, you know, some people in the 1950s said, hey, we're black, this isn't very funny, you guys, then they became little elves and little guys with, like, you know, oh, we're nondescript short men, haha, no racial prejudices here. So there you go. The history of Santa Claus is a sick and distorted thing. And, you know, pray to God. Pray to God all the time. Tell him, her, it, your woes, your problems, your issues, and ask for help. It's a beautiful thing, and the divine will probably help you if you ask for the right thing.
Or, you know, perhaps better yet, rather than praying to some imaginary imbued spirit in the sky, you could go out there to the forest and get down on your knees and, like, pray to nature itself. And the ultimate symbol of nature, perhaps, arguably, is the tree.
Fascinating and fantastic segue, Sue. I love the way you just stretched that into the tree. Now, the tree. What is the tree to us? The tree is a direct hotline to the divine as well. If you ever gotten in a tree and just hugged the hell out of it and just felt like you just melded into the tree, y'all know what I'm talking about. Now, tree worship. Why do we have a tree in our house?
Segueing into the tree, there's a quote from the Bible that, as we know, paganism was something that had to be stamped out by Christianity as it spread throughout the world. And one of the ways that this is instructed is from this quote in the Bible. Thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen, for the customs of the people are vain. For one cutteth a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe. They deck it with silver and gold, they fasten it with nails and with hammers, that it move not. Jeremiah 10:2-6. I mean, because of what we're going to be talking about coming right up here, there might be some good didactic lesson in that as far as actually cutting a tree from the forest, but clearly it illustrates that quote from the Bible that this has been going on for a long time, that the trees were revered as a pagan custom, and that they were decked out in a celebratory fashion. So now we're going to take that to modern times,
well,
where there's so many humans on this planet wanting planting trees in their houses.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to take us back. I'd like to stay in the 7th to 8th centuries, because when does the tree first appear in the house? It does in those times. It appears in temples. But now, let's talk about just the fall of the Roman Empire. I just really want to get into the symbolism of Catholicism upon the tree. So one form of worship supplanting the other. And I think it bears sort of examination here a little bit. The tree, now, let's look at the fall of the Roman Empire. Within about the 7th century, Rome falls. And what happens? There's a void. We look at it as the Dark Ages or some kind of strange period of time where nothing went on. And of course, that's wrong. Something's always going on. It just matters who rewrote history. So who writes about this period is the Christians when they get their act together about 300 years later. But what happens between the 7th and 8th century is something called the Great Migration Period, which is a time when the Germanic peoples really get to wander the earth. They're kept sort of at the walls of the Alps, I guess, or Italy for the longest time, and then the Roman Empire just gives up the ghost, and then the Germanic peoples get their day in the sun. And they're great tree worshippers. They love their trees. They love their Irminsuls, their power trees. They fight for their trees. They worship their trees. And Christianity, when it finally gets its act together, quickly understands that to cut down the tree is to eliminate those tribes' source of power. There's many, many documented instances where missionaries go into a place where there's, you know, the Visigoths, the Vandals, and what they do is they chop down their tree in order to destroy the power of that group. Now, a tree, by any other name, an Irminsul, is simply a byname of our old friend Odin. Odin, or Ermin, is God. So a tree is God. It's a direct worship of God. But we've touched on that before. Charlemagne orders the destruction of Irminsuls as he goes through and conquers Germany. It's well documented. This goes on in the 9th century. There's art dated from the 9th century in Detmold, Germany, where you have Nicodemus, the great Christian conqueror, with his foot on a tree that's bent over. Middle Ages, objects of worship are placed on top of the tree. You cannot stamp out humanity's desire to worship trees. What you can do, if you're smart Christian spin doctors, is put things on top of the tree. All right, we can't stop you from worshiping the tree. So here, keep your tree. Now there's an angel on top of it. Here's a star. It's all good, right? You guys, it's like turning the other cheek to something that's deep seated within us that Christianity can't stamp out. There's many of these things. One of the greatest examples, where does the evergreen become a Christian symbol? It's more Vatican poodle-addle, as my grandpa Ivan used to say. Thor's oak is one of the greatest Irminsuls. It's named, like, these trees had names. That's how much people loved trees back in the day, and they still do. In 1723, St. Boniface, or in that day, Winifred, in 1723, he chops down the greatest of all Irminsuls, Thor's oak, the mighty Thor, right? And the Christian legend goes that the people looked in awe and were sure that Thor would strike him down with a thunderbolt if he were to touch the tree. And since he didn't, and it chopped down, thus Christianity became the greatest, you know, blah, 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 garbage,
because
right?
A fir tree sprouted out of where the oak
right.
was
and
cut.
Right, and that myth doesn't even start until 700 years later, when they realize that they simply can't stop people from worshiping trees. You can cut down the big ones, we'll just go to the next biggest one and worship that. It's just, that's the way we are. That's, maybe it's just hardwired. Maybe we just remember when we were Australopithecines and just developed opposable thumbs and climbed down out of it. Like, you are life, tree. Thank you very much. So, what happens is, in the Middle Ages, we chop down a tree.
We have to segue into modern times.
Okay, we're getting there.
Soon,
we're getting
but
there.
We're in the 8th century.
Christianity, no, we're in the Middle Ages now. Just okay. Bear with me. Christianity then realizes that it cannot stop the tree. So what happens is in the Middle Ages, they make up this new myth about when St. Boniface cut down Thor's oak, an evergreen grew from its roots, and the evergreen would be the symbol of Christianity. They're just taking one tree and saying, this is a Christian tree, and the oak is not such a Christian tree. It's all just a bunch of phooey. What that does, let's take it up to the Christmas tree industry. It's an multi-billion dollar industry. $1.5 billion is the last statistic I had in the States. It's over $80 million in Canada. It's touted as a great thing. 82,700 acres of prime Canadian woods is dedicated to Christmas tree
production.
Can I insert
a little fact
here?
You
can insert whatever you like, Sue.
The Christmas tree market, according to one website, was born in 1851 in the United States when a Catskill farmer, Mark Call, hauled two ox sleds of evergreens into New York City and sold them all. In 1900, one in five American families had a Christmas tree. By 20 years later, the custom was nearly universal. Now, I don't want to mislead listeners. Germany, it seems, is probably where the having a Christmas tree in your own home first originated from. Again, that's only depending on who you read or listen to about a three or four hundred year old tradition. So it's a fairly new phenomenon, having a Christmas tree in our individual nuclear family homes. As Miles has illustrated, though, the tree itself as a symbol has been worshipped and imbued with much spiritual strength for time perhaps immemorial. Take it away.
Right. Anyway, the Christmas tree industry today has numerous chemicals that it is registered to use on its trees. These include such California-recognized pesticide action network bad actor pesticides, herbicides, and rodenticides with such fascinating and beautiful Christmassy names such as trichlorfon, methylbromide, diazinon, permethrin, hexanizinone, cloparalid, tebufenoside, pimetrazine, bifenazate, carbaryl, dimethoate, and dimethylamine. Pass me the eggnog. I'm just getting so thirsty. Now, those are really...
Hey, kids, you want asthma for Christmas?
Yeah, you know what those do? Those are great things if you want to just grow monocultures. If you want to grow monocultures devoid of berries for birds, undergrowth for caterpillars, and all kinds of, you know, if you just want to grow a freaky tree, you should use those things. And since there's billions of dollars up in the mix, they do use those things. Who are those things produced by? All the regular players. Bayer, DuPont, Monsanto. They got it, you know.
Just an interesting question that occurred to me. Do you think people are, like, emotionally attached to what their Christmas tree looks like as a kind of a representation of their own self-worth?
Absolutely.
The more pretty and perfect it is, the more they feel good about themselves?
Mm-hmm. They don't really understand why, because they still want to love a tree. But anyway, let me just read you some really great quotes from the scientific think tank that is the Canadian Christmas Tree Growers Association. And this is me putting on my sarcastic hat. And I quote from the Canadian Christmas Tree Growers Association website, "The biomass of recycled and reused Christmas trees allows us to continue to benefit and profit from the sun's accumulated energy." These guys are way out there. They're at the vanguard of science. It's amazing. I have a live tree in my home. Little Douglas Fir. Doug is his name. There are some gifts under him to pray to the spirits that reside in his roots, which was the original intent of putting gifts under a tree. There are warden trees in Scandinavia and Germany, large trees on farmlands that were believed to house spirits. And to touch or to hurt these trees was a very bad thing to do. And in order to appease the wights or the little bad things that lived under the tree to keep your farm prosperous, you'd put treats or gifts for them under the tree.
And what will happen to Doug after December 25th?
Well, I'll either, you know, keep him inside because now he's sort of woken up from his dormant wintertime stage. So I'll keep him inside, perhaps plant him in the yard come springtime. Or what I might do is simply return him to the Native Abundance Nursery, where they do just take back the trees that they rent, put them in the greenhouse, and replant them later. Sue?
So one thing around the Christmas tree debate is whether artificial Christmas trees are better for the environment or not. So actually, apparently the debate is done. There is nothing environmentally sustainable about artificial Christmas trees from the lead that was used and recently banned to all of the plastic that eventually will end up in a landfill. Great, we have a caller.
We have a caller.
Yes.
Let's hope it's not a wrong number. Hello, you're on the air with Miles and Sue Running Wild.
All right, this is Anna from Gabriola.
How are you?
And a very interesting topic here, because I was just talking about that with my son. He wants to go out and dig up a tree and then, you know, replace it. Mm-hmm. After the season is over.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying to him, well, maybe if you bought the already cut down Christmas tree, and after the season is over, replaced it into the forest where it can be home for all kinds of bugs and spiders and little birds and all that sort of stuff, sort of like food for the forest, you know?
Interesting point, caller. I can see your concern. You do have to be careful of the roots of the tree when you're digging them up.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe having the tree indoors for weeks and weeks at a time isn't the way to go. You can also bring it in for the actual festivities of Christmas morning, Christmas Eve, before it gets too shocked by the by the change of climate. But
I mean, better yet, why not, you know, go into the woods, find a beautiful tree, put something on that tree, make that your Christmas tree. Go back into the woods, love your pagan roots, love the tree as a symbol of God, and dress it up.
And deck your halls with boughs of holly and cedar and fir. I mean, there's lots of trimming that can be done. And my house smells amazing right now, but I didn't cut a tree.
We are
very sad that we have to conclude this show. I think we could probably run wild for another couple hours here on this topic. So thanks for tuning in, listeners. And best of the season to you. I don't know if we have any concluding thoughts, Miles, that you needed to get off your chest.
Yeah, love your Irminsul, love Odin, love God, pray, and just enjoy yourselves. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Festivus. Happy everything. This is a great time of year. Happy Solstice. Give away everything you have. Your friends will give it back to you times 10.
And your greatest protest is don't stress.